So Parshas Acharemos, which is this week's Parsha here in Chutz Laretz. Someone told me that they were at a shul this morning and Valkori got up to lane and started laning Parshas Kedoshim. He had just gotten off a plane from Israel and he didn't realize that we're on different pages. So over here we're still Parshas Acharemos. So it is a little bit unusual this time of year to be thinking about Avodas Yom HaKippurim, but you know, that's part of what goes on. It's kind of, last year this time it wasn't so unusual because Dav Yomi was doing Yuma, so it was perfect. You know, worked out very nicely. But this year it's a little bit unusual. But nevertheless, this is the time that the Torah draws our attention to Yom HaKippurim and the Avodas Yom HaKippurim. And one of the things that we recite frequently during the Yom Narayim that comes up in our Tfilos and Yom HaKippurim is in the Slichos we say, Ki ata salchan li Yisrael umachlan l'shifte Yishurim b'chol dor v'dor. And the Meshech Chachma wonders about the repetitive nature of that expression, of being a salchan li Yisrael and machlan l'shifte Yishurim. Aren't the Shifte Yishurun Yisrael, and isn't Slicha Mechila pretty much the same thing? I mean, if you were to translate them into English, you'd probably use words that are either exactly the same word, or you'd use words that are what do they call that when two words mean the same thing?
Synonyms
of each other. Thank you. So, is there another word for synonym? Is there a synonym of synonym? So, you probably use words that sound very similar to each other. So, what exactly is always part of the beauty of the Hebrew language is that each word has its own nuance of meaning, even if in translation much of that would be lost. That's pretty much what the entire Sefer Malbim on Tanakh is based on, that yesod, is that there are a lot of words that sound like they mean the same thing, but you just have to see how they're used throughout all of Tanakh to see the nuances of difference in terms of the way that they are used. Also, there is a startling medrash associated with the mitzvah of Kisui Hadam. The medrash tells us that Cain was unsure what to do after he murdered Hevel. There's a lifeless body just lying there, and no one in human history up until that point had ever had this experience of having to deal with a dead body. Meaning, you know, the Gemara famously tells us, as we learned about in the Muksa Shirim, that Shlomo HaMelech had to deal with David's body in a unique situation. But this is an even more unique situation. He's the first one to have to deal with a lifeless body, and he thinks that like something should be done, but it's totally uncharted territory. What are you supposed to do? I mean, is kavura intuitive? Meaning, is the idea that you would bury a body intuitive? I don't know. Maybe cremation is intuitive. Maybe just leaving it there for the animals to eat is intuitive, right? How did he know what to do? So the Medrash tells us something surprising. He couldn't call the Chevra Kadisha and have them deal with the body. So what did he do? So Hashem staged a fight between two birds. And one bird killed the other bird, and then proceeded to dig a hole in the ground and bury the carcass of the. So basically, he saw the entire thing that played out between him and Hevel play out in the bird kingdom, in the bird world, where two birds got into a fight, and then he saw what the bird managed to do at the end. And Cain got the hint, and he dug a grave and he buried Hevel. It fits very nicely with the Gemara in Erevin, right? The Gemara tells us that even if we didn't have the Torah, we would know various midos and proper behaviors from looking at the animal world. We would learn tznius from this animal, and we would learn different chesed from that. And we would learn different things from the way that various animals behave. So here, Cain literally learned the inyan of kvura from the way that the birds behaved. So due to their role in Cain's education, the Medrash tells us the birds merit kisei adam. They get, because they were mechasa, the carcass of their murder victim, so there, and that taught us, that taught Cain, that there's such an inyan called kvura, so there's zocha, that when you shech the bird, you do kisei adam. But what is the deeper connection between kisei adam and the burial of a body? Those aren't really the same thing, right? Kisei adam is not the burial of the body exactly. It's covering up the blood. Is there some sort of thematic connection between them? And a third question. This week's parasha is not the only place we find the concept of kisei adam in the Torah. We find it in Sefer Bereishis. The brothers are deciding what to do with Yosef, and Yehuda says, Ma betza ki narugas achinu v'chisinu as damo. He uses that expression. Now, what benefit would there be if we are v'chisinu as damo, if we cover up the dam of Yosef? He doesn't say cover up our crime, he says cover up his blood. And words are important. That same expression, kisei adam, that we apply to a chayiv of oath, Yehuda uses in his argument not to kill his brother. So what exactly is the connection between Kisei Adam and Mechiras Yosef? So again, three questions. The Meshech Chachmas, Machal, Asolchon Yisol, Machal Shifta Yeshurun, isn't that phrase repetitive? Question number two, this: what are we to make of this Medrash that because a bird taught Kayin that you bury your murder victim, so therefore the bird was Zochet to Kisei Adam? What does Kvura and Kisei Adam, or a fight between Kayin and Hevel and Kisei Adam, have to do with each other? And third, what is the why is it that Yehuda used Dafka, the imagery of Kisei Adam, when he talks about covering up for their crime, covering up for the crime of killing Yosef, if they were to do that, if they would have chosen that route of killing Yosef? So I saw an idea in a sefer written by a friend of mine, used to be a Rebbe in DRS, a wonderful person by the name of Rabbi Baruch Dov Braun. Anyone know Rabbi Braun here? Some of the chaver knows, DRS guys know. So Rabbi Braun was a Rebbe in DRS for a number of years. I don't know exactly how many. And he's a rabbi of a shul in Brooklyn. He's a talmid of Rav Rosenzweig Shlita and of Rav Naftali Yeager Shlita. I believe it is the only sefer that has haskamas from Rav Rosenzweig and Rav Yeager. I don't think there is another sefer that has both. Although maybe my next volume of Hakona Olamo, if I play my cards right, I can figure out how to do that. But he's a very, very fascinating person, very, very wonderful person, and he has an interesting way of thinking about things. You know, from multiple influences in his life, a very interesting way of thinking about things. So it's a kind of vart that I probably would never. Definitely would never think of. Normally wouldn't even, it's just not my way of thinking, but I thought it was fascinating. And what he suggests is as follows, that there seems to be something inherently immoral in killing a chayav oath, much more so than in killing a behemah. That there's a fundamental difference between killing a behemah for our needs, to eat the meat and to enjoy it and to use the fur or whatever else that we may kill a behemah for, versus killing a chayav oath. And he writes as follows, I'll quote it. Our interaction with domesticated animals, meaning a behemoth, is uncomplicated. A simple trade-off frames our relationship. In exchange for nurturing and shepherding them on our farms, plains, and pastures, we enjoy their wool, milk, and even meat. This arrangement is peaceful. Domesticated animals are not our prey, they are our partners. Within this framework, our humanity is never in question. Our relative superiority is never in doubt. The only safeguard necessary against potential abuse is ritual slaughter, whereby we consider the value of each animal one at a time and take its life swiftly and painlessly. Meaning, essentially, when we do shechita, it's a natural progression. There is a relationship with this animal. This animal only lived this long because I took care of it and allowed it to live this long because I gave it food every day. I allowed it to live on my farm. It took up my living space. It took up a place where I own. I was the one that brought it out to graze. I was the one, and it worked for me for all those years very often. I'd shear its wool, or I would schlep my plow. A domesticated animal, when you're dealing with a behemoth, there's a reciprocity, there's a relationship, there's a pre-existing relationship. And it's understood that the end of that relationship comes with the owner who nurtured and fed and took care of that animal its entire life, eating the meat of that animal. But he continues, on the other hand, unlike with domesticated animals, we have neither entered into a mutual relationship with the wild animal and bird, nor integrated them into our society. Instead, to obtain their hide and meat, we must leave civilization and hunt them on their own turf, an arena where there is no reciprocity and no mercy. Meaning when you go and you kill a chayav ha'ov, it's your first interaction with that chayav ha'ov. You had no previous relationship with that chayav ha'ov, and you're going outside of the yishuv. Obviously, chickens you do raise, but for the most part, you go, and that's pretty much the only bird we really, But you go outside of the yishuv, you find the chayav ha'ov, and your first encounter with the chayav ha'ov is, I'm going to kill you so that I eat you. And there is an inherent sense of guilt that comes with that. And that is where Kisei Hadam comes in. When we realize that our relationship is an unhealthy power balance, we experience a certain amount of shame, and to retain that sense of humanity and sense of social contract, we cover up the blood. And that gives expression to our ambivalence about killing an animal with whom we had no prior relationship. I had nothing to do with this animal. I feel a little badly about killing this animal. I therefore feel some deep-rooted sense of shame, and that is where Kisei Hadam is. Essentially, Kisei Hadam is rooted, according to this idea, in fixing an unhealthy relationship, an unhealthy power balance. It's a mitzvah that represents the ability to repair a failing in a way that we treat others. And that's what Kisei Hadam represents. The HaKadosh Baruch Hu says there are sometimes power imbalances in life. There are sometimes relationships that are not that do not seem to be even-handed, that do not seem to be working properly, and there is an ability to repair that. There is an ability to fix that. A person has an ability to overcome that. A person has an ability to change that. So Rav Shechter often points out that all mitzvos peinon l'chavero are rooted in the notion of reciprocity, right? That's why most of the mitzvos peinon l'chavero that involve going really far out of your way do not apply to a nachri. You have no mitzvah bikur cholim and nicham avelim to a nachri, but you're not allowed to steal from a nachri, right? There's an isser because I don't expect a nachri to be mevaker cholim me, or to be menachem avel me, or to donate a kidney to me, but I do expect that he doesn't steal from me, right? So I have to live up to that social contract, that there is this sense of reciprocity that you have between yourself and other people. Essentially, in the words of Hillel, that's ben adam l'chavero. Ben adam l'chavero is you live up to that ideal. And it's therefore not really so unusual. It's no wonder that the Kisei Hadam is used by Yehuda in navigating one of the most toxic human relationships in Jewish history, the relationship of Yosef and his brothers. It is the paradigm of toxic relationships, and we still pay the price for that toxic relationship. So Yehuda uses the imagery of Kisei Hadam to show that it's specifically in discussing how embarrassing that sin would be of killing Yosef, that he says, what do we have to gain by committing a crime with the inevitable result being that we're going to feel a sense of Kisei Hadam? We're going to feel a sense of we have to cover up this blood. Meaning we're deciding right now whether we should engage in something that's going to lead us to an automatic inherent sense of guilt, a sense of shame for a sin that we committed. And one can only imagine the kind of shame that Cain probably felt when he killed his brother. He was the very first murderer, right? No one had ever done that before. And Hashem arranged the birds to teach Cain how to be the very first person to do chesed shel emes, to bury his brother, to do a kavura. If the birds or the beasts, according to another version of the Medrash Chayos, if they were the ones to teach proper treatment of a dead body, they deserve a sense of Kisei Hadam when they're killed for human benefit, because it serves as an acknowledgement that there's something unfair about the relationship, that there's something imbalanced about the relationship. Meshachma points out that there are two archetypical sins for which we're punished b'chol dar v'dar, that we still haven't gotten past. There's the sin of the Egel Azav, which represents all Averus Bin Adam L'Makom, are encapsulated, or I guess it's the paradigmatic example, or whatever the opposite of a paradigm is, the most awful, terrible example of an Averus Bin Adam L'Makom, and the sin of Mechiras Yosef, which represents all Averus Bin Adam L'Chavero. So as it turns out, we still had to do Kisei Hadam in selling Yosef, because that too, even selling him, even not killing him, even selling him was an unfair power balance. It involved a group of a bunch of older brothers ganging up on one defenseless younger brother without a mother who can come to his aid, and therefore there was an inherent power imbalance. So we still need that sense of Kisei Hadam with what happened to Yosef. So when we look for forgiveness for these two things, for Ben Adam L'Makom and Ben Adam L'Chavero, Ki ata solchal ni Yisrael u'machlan l'shivtei Yeshurun b'chol dar v'dar. Hashem, you are the solchal ni Yisrael. You forgive Yisrael. Eile Elohecha Yisrael. Klal Yisrael that did a chela egel, that declared Eile Elohecha Yisrael. He gives slicha for Yisrael. But second, says the Meshech Chachma, Hashem, you're also the one who is mochel Shiftei Yeshurun, because Shiftei Yeshurun represents all Ben Adam Lechaveiro. That was committed in its worst sense by the Shvatim, the tribes who sold their brother and sinned in this terrible way. Ben Adam Lechaveiro. Mesh Chachma explains that's why the main Avodas Yom HaKippurim happens in the Kodesh HaKadoshim and not in the Azara like most Avodas of the rest of the year. Because Gemara in Yuma Daf Yud Beis says that the Azara was partially in Yehuda's territory, while the Kodesh HaKadoshim was entirely in the territory of Binyamin. If we're going to achieve forgiveness for Ben Adam Lechaveiro, we have to stick to the territory of the one brother that had no part whatsoever in any of the conversations or any of the activities surrounding Mechiras Yosef, that was not at all an active participant in Mechiras Yosef. So it has to take place, says the Mesh Chachma, in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. In fact, when entering the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Gemara tells us, Kohen Gadol doesn't wear Big Day Zahav because Ein Kategor Nasa Sanegar. It was Yonah's Bar Mitzvah Pshat, Ein Kategor Nasa Sanegar. We prefer not to proudly display anything reminiscent of the Egel when we're looking for forgiveness. And there's another kategor in the Shmona Bigdei Kohen Gadol, when he wears the Shmona Bigdei, the stones engraved with the names of the Shiftei Yeshurun. So the Kohen Gadol would prefer to avoid any reference to either one of those Averos, not to have any Zahav, and not to have the Shiftei Yeshurun on his chest as he walks into the Kodesh HaKadoshim to achieve forgiveness for both of those elements. So what emerges from this idea is that very often the context through which violations Ben Adam Lechaveiro happen are based on relationships that already have this imbalance, that already have this sense of someone is in a more powerful position than the other, and there's a certain ease with which one can take advantage of the other person. And sometimes people don't appreciate that. I'm specifically talking, you know, I always try to be mindful that I'm talking to many future rabbis, that sometimes a rabbi doesn't realize that he's the rabbi. I was just talking to someone yesterday, one of our Talmidim, who's in his first position, and he was saying that he tweeted something or something like that, and one of the other rabbanim told him, for a rav, you shouldn't be tweeting that. Whatever it was, I don't think it was anything too, too crazy. But he said, for a rav, I'm just a guy. And then, like, it hit him. I guess I'm not just a guy anymore. Like, I guess at some point, you have to, like, realize that the way the world sees you. I remember I learned this lesson. There was someone in my shul that had done something, Ben Adam Lechaveiro, that I found very, very objectionable. Very objectionable. So I called, it was a woman in the shul, she had used social media in a way that I thought was not the appropriate way to use social media. So I called her up, and I said, Zalob Seder, you can't behave this way, and, not okay. That was pretty much a conversation. She was a little bit stunned, and then a few minutes later I got a phone call from the husband. Okay, whatever, it's good. I told the husband, there's a story I tell often, I told the husband how proud I was of him when he called me. I said, I'm so proud of you. He said, what? I said, I didn't even let him get a word out. I said, yeah, because you're calling to defend your wife. And you know that what she did was terribly wrong, but you know that you're her husband and you have to defend her. So I'm very proud of you. You're doing the right thing. You should defend her, even when you know what she's doing was wrong. So I remember, it was great. The guy said, all right, Rabbi, so we had this conversation? So I said, yeah, we had this conversation. And that was it. And then he hung up the phone. That was that was the whole thing. But like, it occurred to me afterwards, why was that such a big deal that the husband had to call me afterwards? Like, what do you mean? I'm just calling you up, tell you. By the way, you shouldn't do that. But it wasn't that Ari Leibowitz was just calling up. It's the rabbi of the shul got on the phone and called me out, to call me up to give me personal mussar. It wasn't like even a veiled reference in a drasha, it was like personal mussar singling me out and it occurred to me, like, I may view myself in a certain way, but by virtue of my position, other people are going to view me differently, and therefore that creates an inherent, I don't know if you call it a power imbalance, but some sort of imbalance, which means that you need to be extra sensitive in the way that you treat other people. Because if, you know, Joe Schmo blue checks a person or whatever, your father blue checks, you know, that's one thing. But, you know, but why is the rabbi ignoring me? He's ignoring me. And it's and all of a sudden it becomes something that's very sensitive. It becomes something that's very insulting and very hurtful to people. It's not always easy to be mindful of that constantly. It's something I'm always failing in, but it's something that a person should be mindful of, that when there is this power imbalance, there's this need to sort of fix this power imbalance, and part of the way to do that, and just in Ben Adam L'Chaveiro in general, is to be able to try to see the world through the eyes of the other person, of the people that you're interacting with. Rabbi Reisman always points out, I've heard him say this a few times, that he finds that when people buy gifts for other people, they buy a gift that they like, meaning that the giver would like, with paying no attention to whether the recipient cares or not about that gift. He said that people bought him like these collector antique svarim. He said, "I'm not a svarim collector. It doesn't mean anything to me. I prefer the new print where I could read the you know." But the person was a collector. That means a lot of money. He said that he brought it home. His wife said, "So should I put this in Seamus?" He's like, "No, it might be worth something. Like, I don't know. What do you do?" I remember when I was teaching in DRS, there was a boy in the yeshiva after 11th grade bought me a baseball signed by Andy Pettit. And like, it was so meaningful to me because I knew in his world where he was, Basher Husham, at that time, that was the most valuable thing that he could possibly give me. Meaning that was the greatest expression of love that he could muster as, you know, as an 11th grader. Now he's not an 11th grader. Now he's a Rebbe. Now he would probably buy something different. But that's the way people are naturally. We buy something, you know, a rabbi will get on Purim, he'll get like a really fancy bottle of schnapps. To him, it tastes like lighter fluid. It doesn't mean anything to him. But for the person who's a collector, who's got $100,000 bottles of schnapps in his... wherever they keep these things, in his cave, I don't know. So that's meaningful to a person. So it's important that a person, Ben Adam L'Chaveiro, to recognize what the nature of the relationship is. Meaning it's not a one-size-fits-all how you interact with other people. It's not one-size-fits-all. There are some people you could talk to in a certain way, other people you can't. Because you have to, I think what Rabbi Braun is bringing out is to just appreciate the nature of the relationship and what the power balance is in the relationship and what the background is in the relationship before interacting with another person. Okay.